I've been them all over the country, everywhere I could go. But while I lived in Las Vegas, I did them mostly in Las Vegas and Arizona.
So when they take the silver dollar, they got to go around different banks.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome you wiretappers out there in wiretapper land. We're here in the Big Dumb Fun Show studio in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, first of all, tonight, we're on the third and final episode of the Hole in the Wall Gang, but again, I want to thank our helpers. We've done some, audio reenactments. You know, you watch these documentary films and they do reenactments. Well, we're doing some audio reenactments because there's people out there that are dead or we can't find or won't give us an interview anyhow, some of these crooks, and mainly we can't find them or they're dead. So I want to thank Alex, the man of 1,000 voices, Virgo. I want to thank our good friend, comedian Kojak, and our Chicago friend, Ben Ellickson, and they did their impersonations of Sal Romano, Ernie DeVino, and Larry Newman. Kojak did Larry Newman. Ben Ellickson, with a good, great Chicago accent, did Sal Romano, and Alex did his New Jersey accent for Ernie DeVino.
Now you're giving it all away.
I know.
People are going to listen to the episode.
I got to be honest.
And go, that's not Sal.
I know. I got to be honest. The rest of the voices you hear will be from the mouths of the men that did it, and one guy who has studied this, Denny Griffin, who's written several books on the subject and collaborated with Frank Culotta on several books. But the rest of them will be out of the mouths of men that did it out there in Las Vegas. Now, Aaron, we are in Las Vegas in 1981. What were you doing in 1981? That was the year after the big heat wave 1980 in Kansas City, and I believe did we go to the World Series in 1980? I think we played Philly in 1980, got beat, but we're in 1981. What were you doing in 1981? Were you still in high school?
I was in high school.
Okay. I was a young policeman in 1981 working in the intelligence unit. So law enforcement out in...
Wait a second. You were a young policeman in 1971 when you started working as a policeman.
Well,
You were still a young policeman.
I was still... 10 years later, I was still a young policeman. I was only 36 years old then.
1991, he was still a young policeman.
1981. I was only...
2001, he was not a policeman anymore, but he was still young.
Thank you. Thank you very
much.
You
know, it's all about telling a good story.
It is. It's all a matter of perception, isn't it? Whether you're young or you're old, I always think young. That's why I've got a motorcycle and try to do all the young things I can. You know, in 1981, after the 70s, you know, we put a ton of pressure on the Kansas City mob in the later 70s. And by this point in time, we have uncovered the casino skimming. A lot of pressure on all the Midwest mob families to get them out of Las Vegas. The Chicago outfit, the Milwaukee and Cleveland outfits, and the Kansas City mob, all the upper echelon people have RICO cases. That's racketeer influence and corrupt organizations. RICO cases pending in the first casino skimming trial. It's set in 1983, and that's for skimming from the Tropicana. The second skimming trial will take place about 18 months or so after that. And that was for skimming out of the Stardust.
Well, but it was 79, February 14th, when the...
We served the search warrants.
When they served the search warrants here in Kansas City, Chicago, Milwaukee.
And Cleveland.
And Cleveland. So, I mean, these guys must have had some idea that maybe their reign was coming to an end.
Well, they knew the heat was on, but they were still skimming. Actually, they had gotten a new guy put in the Stardust, and he continued to skim during this time. until, you know, I'm not sure exactly when it stopped, somewhere during this time between those two trials, why they totally stopped the skimming. They got Al Sachs out of that. The Tropicana was sold to somebody else, big corporations started moving in by that time, and the skimming was done by, say, 1984, 85. And here in Kansas City, we weren't thinking anything about a burglary crew in Las Vegas. But in Las Vegas, the Metro Intelligence guys, our friend Kent Clifford, who we heard from last week, and the FBI surveillance squad are teamed up, and they're focusing on the Tony Spilotro burglary crew. And a lot of it's because of bad publicity that they had received after the Las Vegas Metro police guys, after the Las Vegas Metro intelligence officers killed Frankie Bluestein. We dealt with that in episode 2. The hole in the wall gang was getting a lot of publicity because they do a high end burglary, like a $400,000 or $500,000 burglary of a jewelry store, and get coins and different kinds of maybe furs and things like that. And they'd always leave their trademark hole in the wall or hole in the roof. There'd been threats against Sergeant Gene Smith and Detective David Gruber of Metro over the killing of Frankie Bluestein. And Commander Kent Clifford, you remember, he took his famous trip to Chicago and told Alan Dorfman to tell all the heads of the outfit in Chicago that if the contracts were not called off on his men, Gene Smith and David Gruber, he was going to come back and kill them all and everybody else that was around him. The FBI Organized Crime Squad in Las Vegas had some new blood in their surveillance squad. The new supervisor, Emmett Michaels, he was a tough, no-nonsense, old organized crime investigator from New York City. They have one squad that's dedicated to the skimming investigation because there's still a lot of leads that have to be run down. There's a lot of people that have to be interviewed and public records to get. Help put that case together. But the other squad, the Spilotro squad, had formed a task force with Kent Clifford and his intelligence boys, Gene Smith and David Gruber and the others. And they were going to work as hard as they could on Tony Spilotro. He had drawn so much heat and so much attention over the last few years. He'd been called back to Chicago, been arrested and charged with a murder, and then got a really suspicious not guilty verdict from a judge on that particular burglary, and there's be more on that subject in other podcast episodes we've got in the bag.
Did they actually call it the Spilotro Squad? That followed him around.
I think they probably did.
Were a specific squad following these guys around.
That's all they did. They worked on the hole in the wall gang, basically Spilotro. Play that clip of Emmett Michaels, the new FBI supervisor in Las Vegas.
We were so lucky. Sheriff McCarthy won the election. He brought in his crew, brought in a new crew. Kent Clifford, who was the intelligence officer, Gene Smith, and I'd like to recall some of the other officers that were involved, and I will in a minute. Who, like us, were working around the clock. And they were trying to obtain enough additional evidence to get them on state charges and things of this nature. One of the things that they didn't understand at the time, and I'm talking about Metro, like most police departments, and this is not anything derogatory, their thoughts had changed, but normally if there was a drug dealers, say, working on the street, and they got information, they'd go down and bust them. Well, the Bureau was a little different. Therefore, there was a drug dealer down the street. They would surveil them and find out who their pusher was and take them one step further. They wanted us to act quickly, but we couldn't. We had to do Kansas City. We had to do Chicago. We had to do Milwaukee. We had to do Pittsburgh. We had to do St. Louis. We had to try to get the whole – we were trying to get the whole package together. And sometimes it strained the relationship by them not fully understanding. I'm not saying Kent Clifford didn't understand or Gene, but some of the other officers that were involved in the intelligence branch, which were busting their ass like we were, and they're saying, well, what the hell's the matter with this bureau? Why don't they move? Well, sometimes you just can't do that when you try to do it on a nationwide basis. But the relationship between McCarthy, Clifford, Gene Smith, and the two officers that were involved in the shooting of Bluestein, these guys were just fabulous. I mean, and to this day remain my friends.
So, Aaron, this is often a problem when with local cops, and I know we had a little bit in Kansas City working when you work with the FBI in a joint operations. Local cops, they want to do it now. They want to make a case and put it in court and take them off the street now. The FBI takes a long look, and like Agent Michael said, they were putting these cases together involving other cities. You know, the David Helfrey was U.S. attorney in Kansas City, and his staff was working with Bill Owsley and agents in Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Las Vegas to put together all these skimming cases. They got to get folks and put them in front of the grand jury and get, like I said before, public records, telephone records. Somebody's listening to all these wiretaps, and they're typing up transcripts of all those wiretaps and putting that in front of the grand jury, and have to explain how skimming works to the grand jury, and then get the indictments, and then do discovery and give all the evidence they're going to put in the trial to the opposition. And there was multiple defendants. There was, you know, what, like 3 or 4 defendants in Chicago, 4 or 5 in Kansas City. I think 2 and there no one in Milwaukee, just Frank Balistrieri, unless they put his, in the second skimming trial, I think they put his, to charge his sons. Both of them ended up getting found not guilty. And then they had Milton Rockman and, Angelo DiNardo or something. I can't remember his last name now in Cleveland. So they're putting all that together. Well, they're still working on the street crimes in Las Vegas with this task force.
Well, I think about this in terms of our interview with Frank and how he said this guy comes out of the count room and the guy's like recognizing him. And then he's like, this never happened. Like the mob kind of, they compartmentalized their associates quite a bit, didn't they? So I would think it would take quite a bit to try to figure out who the players were, not just in Chicago and Milwaukee, but on the ground there in Vegas.
Oh, yeah. It was, they even got bad information in Las Vegas. They got information, the FBI got information that a particular guy was coming out from Chicago and he was going to be taking skim back. So they get on this guy. They see him come out, I think maybe more than once. They see him go into the casino once and they see him come back out with a paper bag. They follow him around, and they decide to take him off or stop him, and when they stop him, they get the bag, and the bag has Italian cookies in it. I think they, somebody set him up. I'm not sure. Whoever the source was, they set him up. But so there was a lot of stuff going on. They were still trying to work the skimming as well as see, you got to understand, the hole-in-the-wall gang were doing state crimes. They weren't doing federal crimes. They were doing state crimes, which was these burglaries. They were interstate, some of them, and they probably could have charged them in federal court
based on the amount of
based on the interstate transportation of stolen property. Wow. Maybe if they did it, because they did them all over the southwest part of the United States.
But they were there were some big scores though.
Yeah, wasn't huge small big scores. Right,
$100,000. That's not a federal crime.
Not if it's just a burglary. No. It's not really a dollar amount. Yeah, there may be some new laws, but primarily it's got to be some kind of interstate in order. And if it's just a theft, it's got to have some kind of interstate implication to it before the FBI is going to get involved. Unless maybe there's like a special law on kidnapping, on terrorism. There's a special laws on drug kingpins and terrorism, where you can have a local murder and then it can become a federal murder. But primarily murder and rape and robbery and those kinds of things are all going to be state crimes. But we digress.
We were talking like 1981.
Right.
So they probably didn't have terrorism laws so much back then.
No. I just use that as an example of where you have what normally would be a state crime, you have a special federal statute that will put it into federal court.
Like actually if they went and they robbed a bank, it would be a federal crime versus they break into this guy's garage where he's storing all of this valuable jewelry.
Correct. Or into a jewelry store. because they're not a, federal bank. The only reason that's a federal crime is because there's a special statute that makes that a federal crime. You know, and another problem, he indicated there was some problem between the agent Still and the local intelligence guys. And we ran into that here in Kansas City because grand jury testimony, they can't, the FBI by law cannot tell you what was, what they're learning out of grand jury testimony. They have somebody that's come in and talked to the grand jury and given them a lot of leads, but they can't, they can ask us to go out and help run those leads down, and they can't tell us this is where they came from if they came out of the grand jury. That was always kind of a rub. We used to try to get these FBI agents out after work and get a few beers in them and see if we couldn't get a little more information about the background of what we were doing. But mainly we just, you know, acted as, you know, they said, go out and find this guy and see what he's doing. And we just had to, we didn't have to do it. We wanted to do it. We'd go out and do it and report back to them. Now in Las Vegas, the local boys will eventually forgive the FBI agents because they're going to bring a huge inside source that they developed that gives them information in the hole in the wall gang.
And Frank, he wasn't really worried about the Metro police?
Well, Frank, Metro was driving Frank crazy and his whole crew.
I got to tell you, about this time, Metro was a big, big pain in our ass. These guys were relentless on getting us guys. They followed us day and night, and I don't know how many guys they used on us. I don't know where they got the money to work all these hours. You had a cop by the name of Dave Groover. You had another one by the name of Louis DeTabarez. Gene, I used to call him the Greek, this Louis DeTabarez. You had this guy, Gene Smith, which was, he was a relentless motherfucker that wouldn't let off me. He was constantly busting me for something or another.
Aaron, I'm going to tell you something. When the federal government decides to take down a crew like this and they form a partnership with the local cops and the local intelligence unit, if they're organized crime, that target, I'll tell you right now, that target does not have a chance. I used to think about some of these guys we'd go after and think if they had any idea the amount of resources that are now at our disposal to go after them in regards to people, overtime, technical support, maybe even wiretaps or bugs, use of airplane. It's just, it's amazing. You don't have a chance if you're doing wrong and the feds and partners up with the local police and they decide to go after you. Now, by this time, the Spilatro Squad, as I've called it, has all the usual haunts pretty well documented. That's the one thing that when you first start into an operation, well, you find out where they hang out, because these guys are all creatures of habit, and they'll hang out in the usual places where they feel safe, and everybody knows who's where, and if a stranger comes in, they'll know he's a stranger, and they'll know who not to trust and who to trust, and they'll be public places, usually unless they have something really secret to talk about, and then they'll usually just go out and walk down the street and put their hand over their mouth and talk like that. If this is like a public place, like a club or inside one of the casinos out there or apartments or homes, a lot of what intelligence guys do, and I did a lot of this, is you go in and drink at those clubs, or you would go in if it was out there, you'd go in and just hang around the casino and see who was meeting with who, or if it was an apartment or a home, you would just go hang around outside, run a surveillance, maybe put a van in the parking lot of an apartment and write down the tag numbers and take pictures and see who's coming and going, in order to identify as many of their people and as many of their support staff, shall we call it, or other businesses that they might feel comfortable at, that they're doing business with, as you possibly can. So when you really get ready to do something, maybe you want to see what other activities that they participate in. I remember following a guy during the day, and he went to a bowling alley, and we figured out he liked to go bowl. I think it was an afternoon, weekday afternoon league, like shift workers would go to and bowl in this league in the afternoon, and you could find him there, you know, one day a week. You could always go find him at that bowling alley during that particular time frame. So, you know, all that's important. spot checking that those bowling alleys or those bars, and they'll always have patterns once you do this long enough.
Or maybe he just liked bowling.
Well, he also liked to use a payphone at that bowling alley too. So,
did he have his own shoes?
No, he rented shoes.
Okay, well then he really wasn't a bowler.
Well, he did bowl. He did like to bowl, but he also used that payphone, which is those are important pieces of information too. Or if you follow him into a bar, if you get inside and get, you know, sit down and eat or have a drink, and you, all of a sudden you see him going and using a payphone at that bar, then, you know if that, you know, you get that number, and if that number comes up on another pin register or something, then eventually you start building probable cause that maybe you end up on a wire on that particular phone. You just have to be where they are as often as you can. I remember another time, me and Bob, my partner Bobby Arnold were following this guy who was a professional burglar, and he had a crew a little bit like the Hole in the Wall gang. He stopped in a construction tool rental place. I pulled over and Bobby was riding with me. He jumped out and went in, and he sees him looking at and asking about renting a drill. And this drill was a real heavy duty drill that had a huge electromagnet. I think you had to plug it in. And then that would activate this really super powerful magnet in which you could, what you could do is like a safe. You can attach that to the side of a safe. And then you had a long, kind of what you call a cheater bar that would bear down on the drill. You might have to use several different drill bits, but you could drill into the side of a safe. And he eventually used that and we took him off and he had that drill going on a safe. So, you know, you just got to keep after. You got to be, like he said, like Frank said, you got to be relentless with these guys. You got to be where they are, everywhere they were.
And he would show up at the rental place and he rented the drill?
He eventually came back and rented it later.
You caught him in an actual job using the drill?
In a bank burglary, yeah, there the drill was.
And I wonder, did he use his real ID when he rented it?
You know, I can't remember.
Obvious there, other than the fact that you're following him.
This was long enough ago that he probably didn't, but he may have. I don't really remember, because had he gotten away with the burglary, had we not been all over him and we caught him inside on the burglary, he would have just got done and taken the drill back and returned it. So
now he didn't. He's not going to get his deposit back.
No, he didn't get his deposit back.
That drill went into the evidence locker, and it may never show up again.
He had much bigger problems than getting his deposit back or paying for that drill, I'll tell you that.
What was the safe that he was drilling?
It was a bank up north of the river.
Just like one of those, like kind of like you'd see in the lobby? Vaults or
no, it was trying to remember now. It wasn't the big walk, it was a suburban storefront bank, they didn't have a whole vault in there. It was a smaller safe that they kept all their cash in when they closed up at night.
But you got to know where to drill the hole, don't you?
Well, yeah, I guess he did.
I mean, I'm just thinking, like, you can't just drill it anywhere.
He was not a cherry. This guy had been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. He was probably 40-some years old when he got popped there.
I mean, he's not got a drill bit the size of his fist, so he can just stick his hand in there.
No. He had to know where to drill. I didn't get schooled on the art of how you drill a safe, but and that's what he was doing, and we found that drill that he was looking at that day. So these officers following Culotta or any other members of the gang that they saw frequenting these different bars and businesses, and you know, you'll like see them stop in, and or maybe they'll stop in another bar, and you'll know one of the officers might know somebody that works in that bar. So you'll go back in later and say, hey, what was Culotta doing in there? What was Ernie DeVino doing in here? Who was that guy in here with Culotta? And then you find out, that was this guy from New Jersey named Ernie DeVino. Those kinds of little things that you get put together. Maybe you'll go back in and find a regular that is in one of your informants. And so you'll tell him, okay, you got to hang out in here even more. And when Frank Culotta comes in, try to get next to him, because he comes in here quite a little bit. So it's just that's gathering intelligence that's not really actionable, shall we say. They always talk about actionable intelligence, not really actionable right now, but it's little tidbits and bits and pieces that you put together, and then when the right time comes, you've got everything you need to take the final action to take somebody down on something that you get the right clue to. where you know they're going to do something. You've got everything, you know, everything you can know about them.
Were these guys hanging out together, all of them, a lot?
I don't know.
I mean, just kind of, you know, Wayne Metek, I could see Wayne Metek hanging out with
Wayne Metek, he did not live in Las Vegas. Wayne Metek was a guy that stayed in Chicago, but would, when they had a job going, he would fly out just before the job and go do the job, and then he would actually drive down to Phoenix or take a rental car down to Phoenix or down to L.A. and fly back. So, but the ones that lived out there, they hung out at the Upper Crust, the pizza place, and the My Place Lounge, which was right next door. They, you know, they were seeing these guys all the time. They were seeing Tony Spilotro hanging out with Frank Culotta and Ernie DeVino and Larry Newman. Wayne Metek would, you know, he'd come in and out of town, Leo Gardino, and it's Joe Belasco, and they knew that they were all professional criminals.
And they knew they were doing something because then these crimes would be reported.
Yeah, they... You know, they suspected him of being the hole-in-the-wall gang. If you think about it, if they went back and looked into, and I'm sure they did, they look into Frank Culotta's history, they would find in 1957 he did a hole-in-the-wall kind of a burglary of a bank just outside of Chicago and got caught in it. So, you know, they had done that kind of stuff. He'd used tools before. He caught him with a bunch of tools in Chicago. So they knew that they were probably the hole-in-the-wall gang. They just have to catch him in the act. It's really hard to catch them in the act. And sometimes you don't really know what you're seeing when you're seeing it. You just have to keep looking and trying to develop sources and putting it together and hope you get lucky. Go ahead and play that Denny Griffin. This is Denny Griffin, who was Frank Culotta's biographer and wrote probably the kind of the definitive book on this era in Las Vegas called The Battle for Las Vegas.
The group Frank put together was... He had a couple of guys. It was generally six of them. Now, obviously, for small capers, all six wouldn't go. But anything major, they'd have the full crew and sometimes even bring in reinforcements. And he had two or three guys that were capable of doing anything, including murders. A couple of them were primarily thieves. They were burglars and robbers and so forth. And what they would do is some of the loot they would take during their burglaries, they would... handle it through Tony Spilotro's Gold Rush business, his jewelry store that he ran. Things that could be easily identified, for example, a watch with a person's name in it, rings with special identification features. What they would do is they would generally go to Palm Springs and they would unload that stuff there because they didn't want to have somebody come in the Gold Rush and find their own merchandise in there for sale.
So Tony Spilotro had a full-service gang going here. He could fence stuff out through his business, the Gold Rush. He would help set up scores. He had connections back in Chicago. They'd take stuff back to Chicago. Obviously, they had some kind of fencing connections down in Palm Springs, a lot of high-end jewelry stores down there. So they had it all going for him at this point in time. It's the spring of 1981. They start Frank and his crew, particularly Wayne Metek, Larry Newman, Ernie DeVino, Leo Gardino, and Joe Belasco are putting together a score on Bertha's Gifts and Furnishing. It's a high-end jewelry and furnishings like furniture, anything you'd want for your house, gifts in Las Vegas. It was on Sahara, just west of Maryland Parkway. The actual address was 896 East Sahara Avenue. I don't remember if I gave that before. It's not there, of course, anymore, but you can drive by 896 East Sahara, you'll see where Bertha's Gifts used to be.
Is that in the Kansas City Mob Tour app?
Yeah, it is, in the Las Vegas section.
Right.
I forgot the Las Vegas section. That's the hidden section. You have to know the secret password to
unlock that.
Now, at this point in time, Tony's going to add a new guy to the score. Now, this was a fateful decision. His name was Sal Romano. He was a unique individual. He was a longtime Chicago burglar. He'd been down in the Southwest, done other scores. Ever since he was a kid, he loved tinkering with alarms and electronic things and locks, and he was a lock picker. And he was trusted, you know. They knew that He was a guy that had a long time history, never ratted anybody out before. He really would go out of his way to avoid problems on a score, maybe a little farther out of the way than many other people thought he should have. Let's listen to our friend Ben Ellickson reenact Sal Romano.
I was always good at figuring out how to get into places, like picking locks, and I liked the challenge of working around an alarm system. Tony knew I had skills that Frank didn't. Tony sent me down to Phoenix and told me to help Pauly Shiro out. He set up a score on a guy's house, and there was supposed to be $50,000 in the safe. When I got the alarm turned off and we got inside, a little dog came storming out of nowhere, yapping and yipping. I told the other guys, we got to get out of here. When I got back to Vegas, Tony asked me why I didn't just kill the dog. I told him, I just can't do that kind of thing.
So that was Sal Romano. He could break in your house and steal all your stuff, but he couldn't kill your dog. You got to admire a thief with principles.
I was going to say, I don't want to give away the ending in case people didn't know how this all turned out, but Sal had some other traits as well.
We're going to get into some of Sal's other traits.
Besides his kind heart for small animals.
Small animals. He's a particularly interesting character. One thing about going into these things in depth is you find these people are not one-dimensional people. Now, they started planning this score out.
It'd be a four-day weekend. And the report they had was that there was going to be $1 million worth of cash and jewelry in the safe at Bertha's. They set up they planned it for several months prior. And at the kind of the last minute, Frank had the six-man crew together. All of a sudden, he finds out that Tony has added a seventh guy. And this guy's name was Sal Romano, and he was a Chicago guy. He wasn't part of the outfit, but he was a thief, and he had a reputation as an alarm expert.
So this is around 4th of July in 1981. They chose that because they had a nice long weekend, which is exactly when Frank did that 1957 bank burglary. He chose a weekend. So it's a nice long weekend so they can get in and out. They thought the fireworks would cover up any sounds that they made that a passerby might hear once they got inside. Give them all night long and then a couple of days before the bank opened back up on, I think it probably wouldn't open back up till Tuesday, but I'm not sure. For sure wouldn't open it back up till Monday because this is Saturday night.
Seems like a good plan.
It is a good plan.
You know, they talked about, when we interviewed Frank, and he said, you know, man, that sledgehammer, that first, hole in the wall they made was really noisy. And they wrap it something, so you got to think breaking through the roof of someplace like Bertha's, people might hear you.
They might, but if you got a background in fireworks, people, you know how it is in Kansas City. It sounds like in the evening on 4th of July, especially if it's a nice Saturday evening, it sounds like a war zone here in Midtown. So I've got a feeling that there'd be plenty of fireworks going off in Las Vegas, all the drunks that are out there.
Well, they must not have been close to Fremont Street.
Oh, my God, you couldn't hear anything.
Father's Day weekend, it was loud almost all night long.
Really?
No, and it wasn't 4th of July weekend, it was Father's Day weekend.
Yeah, that was the bands and just the crazy people on the street. Yeah, really, I forgot about it. Put that out of my memory. That was a wild time, wasn't it, Aaron? Frank would get a visit from a couple of Chicago cops who had a few things to say about Sal Romano.
So they come to my restaurant, and I bring them over to my place lounge, and there are two detectives that work for the CIU, and they said to me, we want to give you some information, and we ran it by our boss first, and I knew who their boss was, but the name wasn't mentioned. Their boss was Hanhart. And he went on to tell me that they busted Sal Romano at O'Hare Airport with a bunch of furs, mink coats, that he stole in Las Vegas. Well, they had to give the case over to the feds because it was interstate transportation of stolen property. Well, they said nothing came about the case. Then I relayed this message over to Tony, and he said, you know how the feds are. They could hold an indictment on you for 5 years.
So Tony, he didn't want to believe it. I think he was so hungry for this big score, this $1 million score, that he didn't really want to believe that Sal Romano, certainly, he probably figured the worst case scenario is Sal would maybe rat him out after it was over. But, you know, he could take care of that. He'd just have Sal Romano killed. And then it would be maybe his word, since he wasn't going in on the score, it would be his word against Sal Romano's. But for whatever reason, who knows why he did not pay heed to that that tip from those Chicago policemen. You know, William Hanhart, we did a story on William Hanhart. Mm-hmm. He was, I guess he was a commander of the Chicago intelligence unit. He called the CIU. And I knew he was the overall commander above the command, the on the, you know, like the street commander of the intelligence unit at one time. But he was running a jewelry theft gang himself at the time. So, you know, that's Chicago for you.
Well, it seems kind of odd that these cops would just come out, you know, find Frank and tell him this stuff when they know who Frank is. And that's why they told him.
Hanhart probably sent him out.
Yeah. And so, you know, it just is an odd thing how Tony Spilotro just has to have Sal Romano on this crew, despite the overwhelming evidence. And you know how it is. If people think you're going to catch a case, they go and kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
So here, Tony just ignoring that fact.
Yeah, I don't know. It's inexplicable, as they say. Inexplicable.
Is it possible that maybe Tony wanted Frank to take a fall?
I don't think so. I think it's just one of those inexplicable things that, you know, he just had a brain fart. He just was not, he let it slip. He was, you know, there was something else going on in his life, and he just didn't get the import or how important that this would be, this information, or maybe he didn't believe it. Maybe he thought these cops were, you know, like it was some kind of a plot by the feds to interrupt his score or send him in some other direction. Who knows?
They were just baiting him. Well, man, if we could hear what Sal had to say.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to what Sal has to say. We know a little bit about that.
We always fenced our stuff back in Chicago. That's why I got caught at O'Hare Airport with them furs and such. I thought I had a chance until that FBI agent Don Sickles visited me. If it had been a Chicago case, no problem. But the feds, this is an entirely different story. All I got to do if it's a Chicago case, pay the lawyer that Hanhart tells me to pay, do a little under-the-table plea bargaining, and the case goes away. Them FBI guys, they didn't really trust me so much. They made me take a lady agent along and pretend like she was my girlfriend. This made me very nervous, and I knew Frank suspected something. The lady agent was nervous, too. I think this might have been her first time going around undercover like this.
So when he comes back out to Las Vegas, he shows up with somebody that he says is his girlfriend, who is a flight attendant, so she's in and out of town a lot, so she's not always there. They have an apartment rented, and Frank would say that they would go over there and the lady agent would be there. And he said it looked like, in hindsight, in retrospect, it looked like it was a set. It was a scene almost, the way they planted everything. And it was like too clean and just did not really look lived in. And his, you know, his antenna were tweaking all over the place. But Tony said to keep him in, and so he kept him in. Frank would also say later on that Tony probably had a plan to kill Romano after the score was over. He didn't really think that Sal would set him up in the middle of the score. He figured Sal might leak it out after it was over and then continue to work undercover or feed him information and that kind of thing. And the worst case scenario would be that he might become a cooperating witness, like I said before. But he figured Romano would probably wait to tell the cops about the burglary after he received his cut of the loot. That FBI agent, I bet she was nervous if that was her first go-around. I know they even, I read a newspaper article, they even wired and videotaped all the meetings that they had inside that apartment. It was a total plant, that apartment that they had. I'd love to got some of that audio and video from that case, but that's like a year-long process, and then you don't know if you're going to be able to get it, but that would be an interesting audio for sure.
Well, I mean, you know where it's at. Did they ever bring a case against Sal Romano?
No, they brought a case against the hole-in-the-wall gang.
The hole-in-the-wall gang, and sure. So they had to use that material for for that case.
And anybody like Ernie DeVito went to trial. I think Tony Splatro actually went to trial because I think Tony got a not guilty. That's the one where Ernie DeVito actually testified for Tony Splatro. They got their cases separated, and he testified for Tony Splatro and said he didn't really have anything to do with it. So, yeah, it's out there, you know, if somebody wants to
do the public requests for information.
Well, in this
Freedom
case,
Information Act request?
Well, it's more than that. And Freedom of Information, if it was only that simple for audio, it's a lot more difficult than that. And yeah. I don't know about video. You just don't know where it's going to be. Freedom of Information, mainly they'll just give you written reports.
Anything they may have is electronic, or they can photocopy.
The other stuff, you got to have
special request.
Figure out where it is, and if it's audio, you have to get do a motion with the district court and make sure the local U.S. attorney doesn't have any opposition, which they probably wouldn't. So it's a lot of work. It's like I said, it's a year's worth of work. It took me probably, and I knew I had a whole thing wired in. It probably took me 6 months to get those audio tapes that I got. I knew where they were before I even started. It was right here in Kansas City. I had somebody go look and say, yeah, they're there, and we know where they are. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't even have done that.
Now, Sal Romano was not a made man, though.
No. He's what we call an associate.
He's just an associate.
All these guys are associate. And Frank would not really say, would he say he was whistled in or he was a mustache? I don't even think Frank would say he was a made guy, as we think of. And as Frank said about, if you remember, he talked about Chicago outfit being a little bit different than back east, particularly as far as having ceremonies and making people and all that. They did a little bit of that, but they had so many people like Murray the Camel Humphreys and Frank Sweets and Sam DiStefano, and some of them were Italian, some of them were half Italian, some of them were German, some of them were Jewish, that were really, you know, important people in the outfit, and they weren't Sicilian. Plus, it was started by a Neapolitan. Al Capone was Neapolitan, so it really didn't have that mafia kind. That's why they call it the outfit, I would say. They don't really have that mafia kind of tradition, other than, you know, keep your mouth shut and that kind of thing.
So Frank sat down and he told his story to Denny, who helped him write the book.
Right.
What did Denny have to say about this?
So Frank was very suspicious of this guy. He told Tony, he says, listen, he says, I don't want to go through with this. He said, if Romano's going, he said, count me out. Tony says, nope, it's all planned. We got all the stuff here, the acetylene toy. They had all their equipment in place. And what they were going to do was immediately after the burglary, a couple of the crew members were going to drive everything back to Chicago and turn it over to Tony's brother, Michael, to fence it. So they had all their I's dotted and T's crossed, they thought.
Of course, what they didn't know at the time, with the feds and Metro Intelligence, were all over Romano, the apartment. The girl was a lady FBI agent, and he was briefing them about all these preparations as July the 4th got closer and closer. As I said before, they chose this weekend, of course, to cover up the fireworks, cover up the noise. And plus, the cops would be a lot more busy if they did get some kind of a call on suspicious parties or something. They would be a lot more busy away from there and be less likely to come in or come in very quick.
Well, they'd really have to be busy to call the Spilatro crew off.
Really? I just wonder how Sal felt about being forced to introduce this lady agent into the crew. He must have been a pretty cool customer to carry that one off, because, you know, he knew she was nervous. And I think Frank said that she refused to look him in the eye when she met him, and that kind of sent his antenna up.
Well, it wasn't like Sal had this girlfriend before. He suddenly comes back from Chicago with this girlfriend.
Right, right.
You know, and maybe these guys were, you know, I don't know, it was the 80s, but still.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're Frank and Tony and all these other guys, but, you know, I would be suspicious of anybody who just showed up.
Yeah, I'm kind of, in a way, I'm surprised that they were able to pull it off, but they did.
And Tony said, if it makes you feel better, put him with Larry Newman. Larry Newman was a cold-blooded killer. And if he acts a little funny, have Newman take him out. It turns out that Frank was right on. Sal Romano was an informant for the FBI. He was wired. The apartment that Romano used and his alleged girlfriend had only been met by people once or twice. The story was that she was an airline stewardess and was always in travel status, and that's why nobody ever saw her. It turned out she was a female FBI agent. And when they went to Romano's apartment, everything was being videoed and voice recorded. So when they went to Bertha's that night for this $1 million score, they walked into an ambush. It was joint operation by the feds and also the Las Vegas Metro.
So the night arrives, Aaron, July the 4th, 1981, Saturday night. Store wouldn't be open again until probably Tuesday. And like I said before, it's like the 57 burglary they did back in Chicago. It was a long weekend. They were going to go through, back then they went through the wall. They were going to go through the roof. It was going to go through the roof right above, if I remember right, right above the vault. Frank had already gone in and looked around, and the vault usually would stand open during the day, and he was able to look in there and see that there was no, like, motion detectors inside the vault. So if they went through the roof and went right down into the vault, they had no worry at all. He was crazy with suspicion over Sal Romano. This would not have been a long-term, deep-cover, undercover operation where, like, the lady agent would have to maintain her cover after this was all over. They knew this was a short-term deal. But she would have been covered. I think, if I remember right, they even rented an apartment right next to this apartment, so there was always agents somewhere, you know, within shouting distance of this lady agent whenever they were, she was running around with Sal Romano. If they went into the upper crust, why, she was probably wired up with what we call a Kel kit that would send the conversation out to somebody in a van outside. If they were inside this apartment, they would have been watching it from an adjoining apartment. So if anything happened, they could rush right in. You know, the kind of long-term versus short-term undercover operations like Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone, that was a long-term operation where the guy lived the part. In this kind of a case, they won't really live the part. She would not have stayed at that apartment overnight. She would have gone back to some kind of an apartment out in the suburbs or wherever she normally lived.
But you would think that they would, if they put a tail on her, if they were trying to figure out who she was, you know, they might see that. And the other thing that just seems kind of strange is why would they send an agent in, and this was her first undercover?
Well, we don't know for sure if it was. I just know she was pretty. I figure it was if she was pretty nervous. I know we had one that we used, and it was her first undercover. She did okay, but she was nervous. And I sent one of my female undercovers who had worked narcotics before, and she told me, she said this lady FBI agent was really nervous, and she was trying to think she would compulsively keep talking, and she just could not relax, just compulsively keep talking. I mean, it was pulled off okay what they did, but it was everybody can't do that stuff. Everybody cannot do that. It's very hard work. Anybody, you know, people think they can, think, oh, there's nothing to it, but it's hard. It's hard stuff to do. You know, in those long-term undercover operations.
If you think it's hard for the agent,
yeah.
How hard do you think it is for Sal?
Oh, my God,
he
can't imagine.
He knows that there's just like a turn of a dime, he's going to be dead.
He's dead, yeah. At least they won't kill the agent unless they think she's some kind of an informant or something, and yeah, not really an agent. They learn she's an agent. They just walk, but Sal, he'll be a dead man pretty quick.
Yeah, and he's hanging out with the guys that will do it.
Right, and I would imagine, you know, whenever, you know, like that's over, but he still is going to be around somewhere and back on the streets. He can't just disappear from sight in between these meetings. He's got to somewhere be around. And those long-term undercover operations, I can't even imagine what that would be like where you live that life. They know where you live. They may come to your house where you live. I think they did with in the Donnie Brasco operation. I've read a couple other books by FBI agents where they would, you know, like
show up
at their house. They would know where you live and your car and just, I don't know. I would not want to do that. I don't think it sounds pretty glamorous, but I don't think I'd want to do that. I didn't really even like the short-term undercover operations. That was not my stick. I was good at gathering details and making sense out of what I was seeing and putting things together and developing sources and informants. But as far as actually going in and acting like I was a crook, I was not very good at that. I didn't even try to. We had other guys that were good at that.
Now, what did Sal say about this?
The night we were going to do Bertha's, Tony was all over my case and made me stay close to Lurch. That guy scares the crap out of me. I tried to convince Frank my battery was dead to stay away from the job, but he made me ride with Lurch. I convinced Lurch I had to get out on the street and check something out. I told him that I thought I saw a G-car parked down the alley. As soon as I got away from him, I ran like hell all the way to the casino, and I hid in the bathroom until it was all over.
So these guys, once they start, and I've been involved in these operations, once they start, you got the airplane up, you've got maybe 20, 25 cars on the street. You'll have somebody in a fixed position watching the, maybe even two of them, depending on how big the target is that you're going to hit in this situation. You probably got somebody high enough up to watch the roof, and you got somebody watching the front door and the back door from inside another business. You won't be, or unless you have to use a van, but you try not to even have a van close by. It's best to have a totally empty parking lots or cars that have been sitting there for, you know, weeks or days or whatever, and get inside other businesses and just peek out through the windows. They'll never spot you like that. And once the crew, they'll know that they're loading up. They'll have somebody like on the Gold Rush or maybe the, and then the Upper Crust or My Place Lounge or one of their apartments. And you'll just sit there and watch, and you'll see them leave. And maybe somebody else in another spot will say, yeah, they just arrived over here. Or maybe you'll see three or four of them meet up at the Upper Crust and then take off again. And you know that, that they're moving. The airplane will be up above, and they'll watch them circle around. What they'll do is they'll circle the joint, and they'll circle it. They'll come in close, and then maybe they'll stop in front, and then they'll drive off again. And then they'll just sit and watch. And then they'll drive back in. And then finally, somebody will start making the move. The airplane will be reporting all these moves and watching everybody, and people will know, like, once they go in, they'll then start moving in closer. And
well, these guys had to get onto the roof of Bertha's,
right?
Just, and so, you know, yeah, they can drive around in a car and you can kind of follow them, but until, I mean, at the point that they got to stop, get out ladders, and they've got this equipment that they got to all haul up onto the roof, they're pretty committed.
Oh yeah, they're totally committed. And so it didn't take much to watch them do that. Once that starts going down, They're exposed long enough that you're going to see them do it.
But I remember Frank, when we interviewed Frank, and he talked about it in terms of, you know, his suspicions, and so he was kind of making the block.
Yeah, he was sitting back. They all had radios. They were communicating via radios. I remember the crew we followed like this. They were on CB radio, and we even knew what channel they were going to be on, so we were listening to them talk back and forth to each other. Sal will, you know, as Sal said, he was kind of laying back and tried to claim that his battery was dead. One thing he didn't mention, and Frank did in another time I talked to him, Frank came over with his car and pushed Sal Romano's car off with his car. He said, well, we got to get this away from the scene here. We don't want, you know, if we're going to have to leave your car here, when the cops come in and your car is still sitting here and they get your tag, you know, we need to get it away from here. At least not, it was in a parking lot, and at least in, you know, like on the street among other cars, so it won't be quite so noticeable. So he pushed his car off to a block or two away and parked it on the street. But he made him get in with Larry Newman, which is what they wanted in the first place. He tricked him out of that pretty quickly, though. I don't blame him. I'd be wanting to get away from Larry Newman myself, wouldn't you?
Right.
Especially knowing what he knows that he's into, and they put you with Larry Newman.
Now, here's DeVino.
I remember the night at Bertha's, me and Leo Gardino cut a hole in the roof. We never saw anybody around, and the next thing you know, cops are all over the place.
That's when you know you did a good job, when they say, you know, I didn't see anybody, and the next thing I know, cops are all over the place. That's fun. There's nothing more fun than that. I talked about that in one of the prior episodes, and when you can jump in on somebody when they're right in the middle of doing their crime. Once their rooftop lookout sees these men up on the roof and then sees them disappear, they'll drop down inside. They'll call the command post. There'll always be a command post set up, and then he'll call out to the other crews and say, okay, they're in. And the FBI supervisor will be down at that command post. Usually he won't be on the street. and he'll just wait a little bit of time. You need to make sure that they are moving stuff around. You got to show that they're trying to steal something. Otherwise, it's not a burglary, it's a trespass. You got breaking and entering, but it's really a trespass until you show that they have an intention to steal. Then it becomes a burglary, which is a much stronger crime.
You mean they don't actually have to have physical entry to the building for it to be a burglary, but if they're in the act of... It
can just be a trespass or a damage...
Of private property?
Damage property, yeah. But once they get inside and they move something, all they got to do is move one thing. It would show intent that you were going to steal that. You were going to take that back out with you. And lots of times they'll break into some place and they'll like gather up a bunch of TV sets and set them over next to the back door, or a bunch of furs. Gather up all the furs or all the jewelry and then set it down someplace else from where it was. Once they get started doing that, then it's an intention to steal, and then it becomes a burglary. Now the two guys that were going inside and got caught were, of course, Ernie DeVino. We just heard him say that, and his buddy Leo Gardino. And the mobile crews outside were Wayne Metecky, Larry Newman, and, of course, Frank Culotta, and Sal Romano, Joe Blasco. Joe Blasco was out there. He was in a van monitoring police frequencies, but by this point in time, the FBI had gotten some new radios, and they will give the local police radios, these new radios that were coded, and so they couldn't just listen to any radio. They couldn't hear the police talking. Joe Blasco didn't know that. He'd been long enough away from the intelligence unit, he didn't realize the new technology was coming in.
The entire crew was arrested. Romano was whisked away by two FBI agents and taken right into witness protection immediately. And for a long time, the story was that there were six burglars involved in the operation. And in fact, there had been seven, counting Romano, but his role was kept out of it for quite some time. And Frank tells me that he was so concerned that night that the FBI wanted to kill him, that they were chasing him in his car, and he was afraid to stop anywhere unless there were people around. So he pulled into a shopping center so he would have a lot of witnesses, and he felt that would save his life. Now, I have no clue if anybody planned to kill him, But he thought that was a possibility, so he made sure there were witnesses around when he got out and put his hands up.
Interesting. Frank was said, man, they're going to kill me. I better get where there's some lights and some witnesses.
Kind of odd, though, that he's worried about the, you know, the cops killing him.
Yeah, he's got bigger problems in the future, but... That night, he was just worried about the police shooting him. I think probably after that Frankie Bluestein deal, he probably had reason to be worried about it. If it had been that Gene Smith or Dave Gruber, more than likely, when they pulled him over or when he got out of his car, he better not have a sandwich in his hand. I'll tell you that right now. They would have taken him down immediately in a hail of bullets and gotten away with it, too.
Good morning, folks. This is Ed Hobson. We are halfway through a hot, hot 4th of July weekend. We have breaking news at Bertha's Gifts and Furnishings on Sahara, just west of Maryland Parkway. We are getting reports that a major police FBI operation has gone down overnight. We have an unconfirmed source that Las Vegas Metro and the FBI have made a major bust inside this store. We will update you as we learn more details.
Another thing, and from what Denny said, that they perpetuated the fiction that there was one less guy in the burglary crew. They arrested everybody in the burglary crew. And I think the FBI, I'm reading between the lines here, probably were trying to convince the crew that Sal Romano had just gotten away, and they didn't really know, you know, that he was even there if he got away. Of course, they all knew that he didn't show up at the jail.
I remember that night after they took us to jail, and we didn't see Sal Romano anywhere. I knew then that he was a fucking stoolie.
Channel 31 reporter Max Guyman just called and reported that he understands the Tony Spilotro task force has laid a trap and caught the hole-in-the-wall gang inside Bertha's Gifts. Watch our news at noon for an update on this developing story. We now return to your scheduled program.
So they didn't fool Ernie DeVito, and they weren't really fooling anybody. I'm sure of that. You know, this act of taking down this crew was a peak experience for these Las Vegas Metro guys and the Vegas FBI squad. I bet there's a lot of alcohol flowing after they got off of work that night or the next morning whenever they got off. Of course, that's kind of a case that you may be up until 6 or 7 o'clock the next morning when you don't get somebody till, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night. Emmett Michaels, I know one thing, it made his day.
But my greatest day was when we got information that the Hole in the Wall gang was going to rob Bertha's furniture store. So in cooperation with Metro and Gaming, who were really tight at this time with us and who assisted us in this, I was responsible for setting up all the surveillance units. And I was sitting there, and it was supposed to go down at 9 o'clock at night on the 4th of July, and they were going to use the cover of fireworks going off to, you know, to cover the noise up and things of this nature. And as I was sitting there in a covert location, I see this vehicle pull up, and it had some type of car wash or something written on the end. And I see this guy get out, and it turns out to be Joe Blasco, who was a Metro officer. And he gets into the back of the vehicle and sets up his binoculars, and he's the lookout for this operation, which is going to begin. You know, Blasco from day one when we came here, we had information, and we observed him on numerous occasions, meeting with Tony Spilotro, giving him information and things of this nature.
So that had to be particularly satisfying for Emmett Michaels and the rest of the FBI, because they're the ones that actually uncovered Joe Blasco, given information to Spilotro, and made a case on him. I don't know if he didn't have to serve any time, but they did make some kind of a case on him. He was probably got a probation on his first go-around for that evening. He was not on probation after that. You know, and Aaron, have you seen that? You've seen that famous photo of the entire crew, except Tony Spilotro, of course, standing in front of the jail cell, the jail door.
I've seen. Oh, I didn't know there was one where they looked like they were sitting in almost like in a jury box.
Jury box. There's another one where they're standing in front of a jail door, and you can see the bars right behind them. And it's really interesting, and because if you look at Frank, everybody else is grouped together, and Frank is about 2 feet away from the closest person, and everybody else is, you know, like shoulder to shoulder, and he's looking at him with this kind of a disgusted look on his face.
Now, is that normal to have these guys come in and you print them and you photograph them individually like a mugshot, but, you know, is it normal to line them all up like that and get a photo that you're going to give to the paper? Because, you know, that's what they were doing, right?
It would be not out of the realm of possibility to take a picture like that, just to kind of show, you know, how they were dressed in full color and how, you know, their relative size. If you notice, the Larry Newman is about 6 or 8 inches taller than the next highest guy, and so you kind of get it's a real candid look at how they were dressed and how they looked that night. So,
well, and you know, Frank,
and it got released later on, of course.
Frank's got to have a disgusted look on his face. Not because these other guys are mugging for the camera, but because there's a seventh guy missing, and he knows it.
He knew it
before he knew it.
I think that's why he had that disgusted look on his face.
Now these guys are just putting him up there so they can display him.
Really?
I remember seeing that picture of us standing in front of the bars, and you could tell that Frank was pissed.
And so over the next few days, Tony will make sure this crew is bailed out of jail. But then the purge starts. Tony first tells Frank that they got to kill Sal Romano, but Frank applies a little reasoning to this plan because it seems like it's going to be really hard to do.
After this Bertha deal, now Tony's really paranoid, and now he wants to whack Sal Romano. And I tell him, good fucking case. I said, this guy's in a witness protection program. How do you suppose we're going to get him in there? And he said, well, he says, there's this Greek guy that brings these meals to these witnesses whenever they bring him into town to testify. He says, and I could get that information from this guy who caters food to them, and you'll be able to whack him. I said, Tony, I said, this guy's going to be surrounded by federal marshals. He said, well, you shoot them, too. I said, what are you, fucking nuts? I'm not going to go out killing no fucking federal marshals because of this guy. I said, it's impossible to whack him. We got to live with it unless they let him out of jail and let him walk the streets. But I am not going to do it. I said, that's total fucking insanity. And I wish you would have listened to me from the beginning. And then we wound up in a half-ass argument, and that was forgotten very shortly afterwards.
So over the next few months, Tony Splatro will mention to Frank about whacking all the rest of these guys one after another. Just he's so paranoid and so afraid. He's finally come to the realization Sal Romano was working for the government. His irrational behavior is really scaring Frank. But Frank was about done with this life by this point in time.
I had 37 friends that I knew in my lifetime that were all killed by the Alpha, and I just didn't feel as though I wanted to be 38.
Tony Spilotro is in the news again. The Channel 31 news team has an exclusive. Spilotro's chief lieutenant and enforcer, Frank Culotta, has turned government witness. Our FBI sources claim that Culotta will deal a major blow to Spilotro and the Chicago outfit.
He had 37 friends killed. He did not want to become 38. You can't argue with that logic, can you, Aaron?
Except what? Did it take 36 before he finally found some remorse and said, 37, I'm going to be 38. I don't think this is good.
Yeah,
especially
really.
When, you know, he's catching a case for Bertha's. He knows.
Yep.
Here's Sal, you know, Tony's making, you know, these decisions, and it's impacting all of their lives.
Yeah, it is. And if you think about it, by this point in time, Frank he's up around 50 years old. And that I found that to be one of the best prevention tools on recidivism. That's going back to the penitentiary repeatedly. Is once you turn 50, it just gets harder and harder to go in and do, you know, 5, 8, 10 years. It gets really difficult to do. They all got taken down. The good guys won. The bad guys lost. We know that Larry Newman and Wayne Metecky will take a conviction for, if you remember, we talked about that machete murder of the Chicago jeweler, Bob Brown. Frank Culotta testified against him on that. Larry Newman will die in prison sometime after that. I'm guessing that Wayne Metecky is dead. I couldn't find any hide nor hair of him. Leo Gardino will be convicted, of course, for Bertha's burglary, and he will do his time. I'm assuming he's dead. I know Ernie DeVino tried to find him, and he said he couldn't find him. Ernie DeVino was convicted. He was such a stand-up guy to the end. He even testified in a trial for Tony Splatro, claiming that Tony Splatro was not part of the hole-in-the-wall gang, and he never fenced any property from any of their burglaries through Tony Splatro, and I know that case ended with a not guilty for Tony. Now, I did learn a little more about Ernie DeVino because there's that interview of him on Vimeo that he did with his son. He's going to go into drug rehab. He had developed a heck of a drug habit while he was out there running wild in Las Vegas. He probably needed to go to First Call. He said his son needs to make his first call to First Call. And while he was in the penitentiary, he developed a faith in a higher power. He got in some kind of recovery, more than likely Narcotics Anonymous maybe, or Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know. When he came out, he started working in a drug rehab in New Jersey. Tony Splatro and his brother Michael will be set up by the outfit, brought back to Chicago. He'll fly back, he and Michael both, and they'll tell them that they were going to become made member, or not Tony, but Michael was going to be a made member of the outfit, and went to a house in Bensonville, Illinois. Frank Calabrese Jr.'s uncle, Nick Calabrese, testified that IUPA and the outfit had once sent him and a team of shooters out to Las Vegas to kill Tony Splatro, and they were going to use explosives and automatic weapons to make sure he was gone, and that plan was aborted. And it was after that that they lured him to this meeting in Bensonville. And it's what I've read about that when Tony and his brother Michael left to go to that meeting, Tony took all of his jewelry off and left it at home. And that's kind of, he kind of had a suspicion that that was going to be it for him. He was a mob guy right up to the end. He didn't even try to run from that.
As depicted in the movie Casino, they weren't actually killed in a cornfield.
Right. They took him out and tried to bury him in this cornfield and did a crappy job of that.
Although, didn't they end up just beating him to death?
Yeah, they did beat him to death in this basement. And I don't even think they used, I think they just used their fists and their feet, from what I read. Nick Calabrese will testify that there was 10 guys in that basement waiting for them. He even named him James LaPietra, and I have to assume he's Angelo LaPietra's relative. I'm not sure. John Ferrocarota, John DiFranzo, No Nose DiFranzo. He will end up being the outfit boss a few years later. Sam Carlisi, Louis the Mucci Boli, James Marcello, Louis Marino, Joe Ferriola, who was Harry Aleman's brother-in-law, and Ernest Rocky Infelice. But they didn't charge any of those guys with them because all they had was Calabrese's
testimony.
Testimony, yeah. And Calabrese was there, too. His account was that he tackled Michael Spilotro and held his legs while one of the other guys strangled him with a rope. He said he heard Tony Spilotro ask his executioners, "Can I say a prayer?" And he said they didn't. Nobody replied, and they just kept beating him and beating him until he died. As you said, they'll be accidentally found by a farmer in Indiana cornfield. But they weren't killed there, like you said.
Yeah, as depicted in the movie Casino.
Yeah.
And the guys that killed him, it wasn't just two of them with baseball bats.
Right. For over 10 years, Spilotro's hole-in-the-wall gang had ruled out in Las Vegas. And, you know, they cut a high, wide and handsome swath of burglaries and thefts throughout the whole Southwest. They had money, women, drugs, and all the action they can handle. I think Ernie DeVino even had some loan shark action going. They did some collection of loan shark money for Tony Spilotro. But by 1982, their luck had run out. Ernie DeVino found God. Frank Collada, he found Hollywood, or Hollywood found him. I don't know which.
I thought he found he found witness protection.
And witness protection, too.
I mean, he didn't find Hollywood first. He found witness protection because they played him a tape that basically said, hey, you need to tell Tony Spilotro he needs to clean his dirty laundry. And Frank understood what that meant.
Yeah, he was no dummy. Play that tape about Ernie DeVino. It's kind of interesting. This is a reenactment, but these are his exact words.
I'm not a drug addict or pusher anymore. Crime is not a part of my life anymore. I'm a man of faith now.
You know, Frank told us that, if you remember, that film company paid him $5,000 just to sit down and talk in the very first meeting with Nicholas Pileggi. And he ended up, he went out to, he wasn't living in Vegas at the time because he was in witness protection. And he flew back into Las Vegas and he met with Robert De Niro and they paid him another $5,000. And then he ended up being a technical advisor on the movie.
You know, the movie Casino really, really, I didn't, you know, when I died, you know, I was a consultant in that movie. And I spent 6 months doing that movie on the set and I acted in it. I was a consultant. I sat right next to Scorsese on one of the director chairs. They were doing a scene, and I said, "Nah, that's not the way that guy was killed." And Marty said, "Why do you know?" I said, "Because I killed him." And Marty said, "What?" He says, "Well, then you do the scene." Then he threw me into the scene.
So, Aaron, that pretty much ends the story of the hole-in-the-wall gang and what happened to all those guys. We're going to keep doing some caper crimes once in a while. You people from Chicago, you listeners from Chicago, you'll be interested to know that I am researching the Great Purolator heist. It was like a $4.2 million armored car robbery, although it was at the armored car company that was outfit connected. Red Wimette tells a pretty good story about seeing some of the loot from that, so we'll have him in there. If you got any other suggestions, I just stumbled across a Kansas City story that I want to tell. It's not mob, but it's a hell of a story. It's a story about a mother who hires her son and his friend to kill her stepson because she hated her stepson. But if you got any suggestions on caper crimes, why, send them to me. But I need the crimes that have some resources, a book or something about it. I've got a book on the Pure Later Heist, plus I've got an old Illinois Crime Commission report that tells you, was written at the time practically, and tells you more than you ever want to know about the great Pure Later Heist.
What happened to Sal Romano?
I don't know. Went in witness protection. He testified at the family secrets trial. I found one article that said he was wheeled in a wheelchair and looked really old. But I tried to get hold of the agent. There's two agents that were his handlers, and I got both their names, and I started trying to get hold of them, and I found out they were both dead. So I kind of gave up after that. I just didn't know where else to even ask. And if he stuck with his witness protection name, and which he probably did, because he went back and, like I said, he went back and testified at that family secrets trial. And
that would keep him in the witness protection, wouldn't it? Because at some point, wouldn't they be like, listen, this case from Bertha's was in the 80s.
Right, yeah. But that one would, you know, kind of refresh their memory about who he was and what he was doing. Of course, Frank Calabrese Jr., he testified in it, and he laid low for a while, but he's back in Chicago running a mob tour. So, you know, I don't know. Romano could pop back up, but I got a feeling he's probably dead. He was just too hard to find. If he'd run a mob tour, why, I could have found him real easily. We would have had.
Did you do a Google search on Sal Romano's?
I did every search I know how to do on Sal Romano, and I could not find a clue.
All you found was Ray Romano.
Ray Romano, yeah. His cousin, Ray. So I called Ray, but I couldn't get through his handlers.
Yeah, I said, Ray, do you know where Sal's at?
He said, what are you talking to me for, dude? I said, well, like, I'm a comedian just like you are. Oh, that's Aaron that's a comedian. Aaron, I should have gave you that job. You comedians, you all know each other, don't you?
Oh, well, I've never actually met Ray Romano.
No, okay. You should start a new show, Getting Coffee at the Studio, or at the Getting Coffee with Comedians at Broadway Coffee Shop. How about that?
Broadway Cafe.
Broadway Cafe. Aaron meets all of his comedian buddies and his other buddies down at Broadway Cafe.
There's already Comics and Cars Getting Coffee.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to think of some new show that you can do, though.
Well, I have one, but I can't. I got to do a pilot. It's called Bands and Buses Getting Beers.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
It's not crime related, but you get a band and then you get like a bus
and get a 12 pack of beer.
And you go somewhere and you have a beer and then they just happen to have some equipment so the band can do like a little musical performance of some of their music.
Well, you know all the bands and I guess your boys, the Automatic Boys, they'd probably be up for that.
They might be up for that. Filmmaker Blake Fitzpatrick had said, I kind of threw that out to him one day. He goes, oh, we could do that. And I was thinking of the band Sidewise, which you might not know. But
yeah, I don't know them.
He knows those guys as well. But you kind of need somebody with a bus. And I don't mean just, I guess it would be kind of funny if it was a school bus. But, you know, if you changed up different buses, I think that would be kind of like Comics and Cars Getting Coffee, only with bands.
There you go. There you go.
Man, how do we do? We have to do the mob version. I don't know. Gangsters in
buses taking mob tours.
No, it's more like gangsters in vans.
Gangsters in the trunks of limousines taking mob tours.
Gangsters and gremlins getting followed.
Yeah, I wonder if they do that anymore. You know, it's pretty easy to follow people now. I just put one of those GPS locators on them.
On their car. Yeah. They're so small.
I was just reading, it was a true crime story. Oh, it was a podcast. It was a competing podcast, so they don't really compete with us because they just did, like, these kinds of, you know, family members killing each other kind of murders. So
we don't have any of those.
We don't have any. I'm going to have one. That's Sue Ann Hobson.
Bobby Greenleaf.
Bobby Greenleaf. Well, those were strangers, though, that kidnapped him.
We don't just talk about the mob, though.
No, we do some other crimes. I'm going to do that one that is about a family member killing another one, which is so interesting. Plus, I got access to the investigators on it. I was listening to this, and the daughter, the mom was married to this guy. The daughter knew there was something horribly wrong about this guy. he was real controlling and real angry, and the mom was kind of mousy and scared of him, and he was isolating her from her adult children. So the daughter bought two of these GPS locator sending units, and she would take one over real early in the morning and put it on this guy's car and then leave it on there all day, and the battery will run down after a day. And then she'd go over in the night and put a fresh one on there and leave it on there overnight. And then if he went out and went around all night, then she'd go back in the morning and replace it again. But she had two of them. She'd just keep replacing them. So she knew everywhere he went for a long time.
Have you checked your car lately?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I probably should.
Or your bike?
Yeah.
Janice might have put one on your bike. I noticed that you were going 128 miles an hour on 435 in Northeast Kansas City.
She does not want to know how fast I go. She would rather live in ignorance of that fact on how fast. Anytime I even joke about it, she tells me, just shut up. I don't want you talking about that.
Yeah, her and K&N filters both don't want to hear that.
Yeah, I think that's why they never renewed.
I'm guessing that's a liability right there. Even if you know you're supposedly joking about it. Someone would come along to him and go, "Well, I was listening to that Gangland Wire podcast, and Gary was talking about how he took his bike out in the K&N filter, and he was going 137 miles an hour. And I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And well, I can't, and now I'm injured, and I'm suing you."
And it's K&N oil filters' fault.
K&N.
I was just wanting to show what great filters they were.
Yeah, they are.
And I use them.
They are great filters.
They cost about twice as much as your.
Why?
Store.
The liability insurance they have to carry.
I think maybe they didn't renew with us because we weren't really getting that many downloads. So,
it was our first real advertising.
It was the first one.
It was our first. It was our only one, really.
Right, and I'm not doing any more until we get so many downloads that they can really pay us. I mean, people don't really want to hear those advertisements, but you guys got to keep paying us. You got to keep donating money to keep us up here without any advertisers. We're going to do it as long as we can.
I keep looking over my shoulder waiting for the landlord to show up, but he hasn't yet.
Well, good.
Why don't we finish this out real quick and we can get out of here.
All right, we will. If you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, ladies and gentlemen, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. You can get it on Amazon. Buy it, rent it. But if you really want to own it, if you want to see the extras, you need to get the DVD. So go on over to ganglandwire.com. Make a $25 donation if you live in the United States. It's $50 if you live outside the U.S. I'm just saying, because it's that much to ship a DVD overseas. But that DVD has more than you're going to find on Amazon. It's got extras and outtakes, even maybe a clip or two you heard from this Gangland Wire episode about Bertha's and that robbery from some of those cops out of Vegas. You want to get the documentary, and it's so good. The information's so great, and there's so much that you're going to want to know more. And there's more to know. Gary took the time to distill down the wiretaps that they used to convict these guys and made it into a book, word for word, from the mouth of the men that did it. You can read Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and it's an even better listen, because get the Kindle version for $1.99, and then you can listen to the actual wiretaps. There's hyperlinks to video files with transcriptions, so you can read what they're saying, because sometimes it's not just plain English. And if that's not enough, there's more history, and you're going to want to see it yourself. And you're going to do that by getting the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City and Las Vegas.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.